from Washington to Georgia, Kansas to Mississippi, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, should workers have the right to periodically vote on what labor union represents them? Robert Ault of the Buckeye Institute says they should, and he is here to explain why. The Republican tax reform plan is good, bad, and ugly. So says Andy Roth of the Club for Growth, who joins us with the real story. Have you ever gone dancing in New York? If so, you likely broke the law. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine says the city's antiquated cabaret law is about to become history. And the New York Times says women have better lives in communist nations. But do they really? Dr. Paul Kangor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In most states, once a labor union is elected to represent a group of employees, it never has to stand for what is essentially re-election. Here to talk about why that is bad for workers is Robert Ault. Robert is president and chief executive officer at the Buckeye Institute in Ohio. Robert, welcome to American Radio Journal. Robert, when we talk about workers' voting rights, we're not referring here to their ability to vote for candidates in elections, but this goes to union representation. To begin with, what is the normal situation when it comes to workers establishing a union? How does that get done?
Well, generally speaking, there's an election to certify the union as the representative for the bargaining unit. And what happens is if, in fact, they're successful in getting the requisite number of votes to certify it, it ends up being what I refer to as a one-and-done election. Once that union is certified as the representative for that bargaining unit, they never have to sit for re-election again, which creates an interesting condition. If you look at the statistics, 94% of union workers across America have never had the opportunity to vote for the union that's representing them. And that's because the unions were voted in place years ago, oftentimes generations ago, before the individuals began working and had an opportunity to vote. To give but one example from close to home where I live in Columbus, Ohio, the local teachers union is the Columbus Teachers Association. It was voted in as the representative for that bargaining unit back in the late 60s when Richard Nixon was the president and the Beatles were still together. But if you walk into the average elementary school classroom in my neighborhood, the teacher up in front of that class likely wasn't even born in the late 60s. So he or she has never had the opportunity to vote for that union which is supposed to be representing him or her.
In terms of how the union then represents their union members and the type of performance that they're able to put in, the way they reflect the interests of their members, would having a recertification vote periodically enhance the function of labor unions?
What I would say is, let's listen to what workers, unionized workers themselves say. We've done extensive polling on this question, and 85% of union workers believe that having regular periodic elections for their union representation would make those unions more accountable to their needs, which makes perfect sense. If you go to our website, workervotingrights.org, we've got quotes from some of the public sector union leadership in states where worker voting rights has been implemented. And one of them, in a moment of candor, admitted, look, we've been taking our members for granted. We hadn't even been communicating with them well before worker voting rights were implemented. And, of course, that makes perfect sense. If you have one of these one-and-done elections where you never have to stand for re-election, I can imagine most people listening would love it if they had a job where no matter what happened, that they still kept their job. That's kind of the way it is with these union representation votes. It's almost impossible to unseat the unions once they're in. At that point, it doesn't matter if they provide good service, bad service, or no service at all. They're still going to be the representative for that bargaining unit. This really puts the union workers back into the driver's seat by giving them a voice with regard to their representation.
We all know that public sector labor unions have a very large impact on public policy in many states. Teacher unions in particular, as well as any government employee union, has an impact on who gets elected to seats in their state legislature for their statewide races. So what impact is this lack of periodic recertification of unions or periodic votes to keep unions? Robert, what sort of impact is that having on public policy?
I think if you take a look, far too often the positions that might be taken, whether it be the engagement in politics or even the collective bargaining positions taken by the unions, are not necessarily reflective of the desires of the individual members. Or at the very least, the members don't have the ability to keep the union leadership and the unions accountable for these decisions. You hear a great deal of dissatisfaction among union members that the priorities of the union may not align with what it is that they would want. And worker voting rights would assure that those members had a say, they had a voice with regard to how it is their dollars were being spent, whether they wanted them to be spent on the sort of political purposes or speech that oftentimes unions engage in. It would also give them a choice. The interesting thing about worker voting rights is that it injects genuine competition into the labor marketplace. Right now, because of this one-and-done nature of these elections, there's not really an opportunity for unions to compete for business. Once a union is certified, it's very difficult, very onerous to have it decertified. So there's not really an opportunity for another union to come in and say, look, we could represent you better, and we could represent you cheaper, and we could represent your interests more effectively. That's really not an option, but worker voting rights would open the door for that option and allow that kind of competition, which necessarily would benefit the workers.
Who made the decision that this was once and done, and how can it be changed? Who makes the decision to change the process?
Federal law with regard to public sector employees, and again, these are the folks who work for state and local governments. So think about your public school teachers, your government employees who work for agencies. Federal law permits the state to set rules with regard to the regular election for unions. It allows the state to grant worker voting rights through state law. So you'd be looking to the state legislature. They would be capable of going ahead and enacting this. They can do it, and they can set how frequently these elections occur, and different states have used different models. From one state holds the elections every year, another I'm aware of holds them every 3 years. There's a second option that Congress could weigh in as well. I know there's a piece of legislation that's been introduced in Congress that would grant nationwide worker voting rights. I don't know about you. I worked in Washington for a number of years, and I left there to go to the States, to Ohio, for a particular reason. I think that real reform and real protection of individual rights actually ends up emanating from the states. They're actually able to get things done. So I tend to think that a state-by-state approach is both more likely to happen, and I think it's also more in keeping with the American system of government, where we allow the experimentation at a state level. And you see different states applying the rules differently to meet their own unique conditions.
We have been talking with Robert Ault, who is the president and chief executive officer of the Buckeye Institute, that located in Columbus, Ohio. Robert, tell us a little bit about the Buckeye Institute, also where our listeners can go if they would like to get additional information.
Sure. The Buckeye Institute, we're a free market think tank based in Ohio, but we do work in states across the country to advance liberty and remove barriers to prosperity. We do this by working on economic and legal policy. And you can learn more about worker voting rights and how you could advance it in your state by going to workervotingrights.org. And you can learn more about Buckeye and our other initiatives by going to buckeyeinstitute.org.
Robert Ault, the president and CEO of the Buckeye Institute. Robert, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on the big issue of the day, and that is tax reform. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
We now, Andy, know a bit about where Congress is going to start with the tax reform effort. What can you tell us about the House plan?
It's one of those things where it's probably an overused cliche, but there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good, in fact, the great, is that they lower the corporate tax rate down from 35% down to 20%. They go to full expensing. They also switch to a territorial system and repatriate $2.5 trillion from overseas. Now, I know that may not mean a lot to people, but those three things right there will add a ton of new wealth to the country, higher wages, more jobs, more productivity, everything. All of that is absolutely grade A fantastic. The good stuff is that they lower individual tax rates a little bit here and there. They aren't as aggressive on the individual side as they are on the corporate side. They also finally get rid of the death tax. The reason why I don't consider that great, but I consider it good, is because they delay it for 6 years. So starting next year, if they pass this, the death tax exemption will go from $5 million to $10 million. But then you just hope that you don't die for 6 years, and then the death tax goes completely away. The bad stuff, the ugly stuff in this bill includes a new millionaire's tax. You're going to hear it under with different names in the press, but basically there's a bubble rate or a carve-out rate or a millionaire's tax rate, and that's for people making over $1 million or 1.6, I believe, for a married couple. I'm not sure. Now, before people start making it sound like I'm a conservative who only cares about rich people, there are a lot of small businesses that have that kind of income, and they're the ones that produce a lot of jobs. So creating a new higher tax as high as 45-point-some percent, that's really bad news. The other thing that I alluded to just now is that there's also a pass-through tax cut that goes down to 25%, and that sounds good. What that means is that small businesses that pass through their income to the individual code, their tax rate goes down to 25%, but that's actually not the case. They can only allow a portion of their income to be taxed at 25%, and the rest gets taxed at a higher rate. So even though I'm making all of these technical claims, the problem is that small businesses are not going to get a tax cut as big as we thought, and they may not get one at all. We're engaging in a class warfare argument by penalizing millionaires and job creators. And then just the overall weakness of the individual tax cuts. So the Wall Street Journal editorial board actually said it pretty well, which is you've got a great corporate tax cut plan in this proposal, and then you've got a mediocre, indifferent, and somewhat anti-growth individual tax cut plan. And you put those together, and you're kind of left with a mixed bag. So it's really a tough call as to how I would describe the overall product.
As we look at the fact, Andy, that perhaps the individual tax cuts, the tax cuts that might be enjoyed by middle-class families across the country, are not as significant as what had been hoped, what had been expected. This, of course, is a starting point. Is there an opportunity that perhaps when the Senate plan gets fully vetted and this thing starts getting debated, that we could still strengthen tax cuts for families, for working families?
You're exactly right. Let me stress that the tax cuts for the individual rates, they're not nothing. They have seven tax brackets right now. The House Republican plan collapses them down to four. The 10% tax rate goes to zero, and so the next rate goes to 12, and then to 25, and then to 35, and that's a lot better than it was before. So people are going to experience some good tax relief. It's just not as robust as I think we had all hoped. That said, this is just the House plan. The Senate has been watching this House debate quite closely, and I think that they're recognizing a lot of the grumpiness that is being vocalized, and so they will be releasing their plan, and then we'll have the big debate. The House will pass their plan, the Senate will pass theirs, they'll go to conference, and hopefully the end product is going to be just fantastic pro-growth stuff. And to be honest with you, I think that is what is going to happen. I think that the House bill is going to die in the Senate. The Senate is going to pass their bill, and their bill, the Senate bill, is going to be more likely the final product. They are going to combine the two and put it into conference, but I do believe that the Senate bill is going to be the one that is most like the final product, and I'm pretty confident it's going to be very pro-growth.
The fact that Congress failed to do anything to reform health care and all major Republican initiatives have been totally stalled, Andy, how important is it politically that this Congress actually get tax reform done? And aside from how important it is politically, how important is it to the economy?
To your first question, I think the Republicans can kiss their majorities goodbye, especially in the House, maybe in the Senate, if they fail to pass tax reform. It's that simple. Now, as for what will happen to the economy, honestly, there are market prognosticators all over the place with different opinions, but I think the likelihood of tax reform passing, the consensus view, is not that great. It may be 50-50, it may be a little less. So I don't think that the stock market is fully pricing in passage of tax reform. So if it doesn't pass, I think that the market's not going to crater. The economy's not going to crater.
Andy Roth is at the Club for Growth. And Andy, as always, we'd like to end our conversations here on American Radio Journal with you telling us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
It isn't very often a law in New York City actually gets repealed, but the end of this one may have you literally kicking up your heels. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports.
Well, even if you haven't seen the movie Footloose, you probably have heard the song and know the story. It's the story, of course, about how Kevin Bacon's character saves a small town where dancing is illegal by, you know, encouraging people to dance. It's a fanciful story, one of those fun 80s classics. Did you know that until recently, it was technically illegal in many parts of New York City, yes, New York City, to kick off your Sunday shoes and dance around? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a close look at New York City's decades-long nonsensical ban on dancing that has, yes, thankfully, finally come to an end. The city council voted earlier this month to kill the 91-year-old cabaret law that required bars to obtain a special permit involving a comically long checklist of approvals from more than a handful of city agencies before they could get a permit to have people dance in them. Only 97 of New York City's more than 25,000 dining and drinking establishments have such a permit, according to the New York Times, which means that if you've ever gotten down in one of New York's bars or had a little too much to drink and decided to do a little swing, well, you were probably technically breaking the law. Mayor Bill de Blasio supports the repeal, and he's expected to sign it into law sometime later this month, according to the New York Post. And that feels like an excuse for a party. While the city has never enforced the law against couples who get swept away for a moment by chance, it has, at various times in its history, had bar owners living in fear. The cabaret card appendage to the law was a particularly onerous detail that's luckily been gone from the books for years, but back in the 50s and 60s, it kept performers like Billie Holiday, Thelonious Monk, and Ray Charles from performing in the country's biggest music venues. Rafael Espinal, the heroic city councilman from Brooklyn who sponsored the repeal measure that finally passed the city council this year, has been trying to kill the dancing ban for decades. He says that for almost a century, the cabaret law has targeted specific groups, kept businesses and performers living in fear, and stifled the expression of New York City's vital culture. So just how difficult was it to get one of these cabaret licenses? Well, for starters, you could only qualify for one if your establishment was located in a part of New York City zoned for commercial manufacturing. So that eliminates a good chunk of places where most bars are located to begin with. After that, you'd have to get a fire department and electrical inspection. Then you'd have to get permission from your local community board, which might include not only the owners of competing bars and music venues, but neighbors who are worried about loud music. And if you manage to get past that hurdle, then you would still need a security background check and proof of working security cameras in your bar. After that, the city's Department of Buildings would have to confirm that your premises is suitable to operate your business, and of course you had to pay a mandatory licensing fee. And then you still didn't get the permit because the city would run a check to see if you owed child support. And if you did, well, no permit for you. That's right, you can dance if you want to, you can leave your friends behind, but if you don't pay your child support, you're not going to get a cabaret permit in New York City. Like many other broad but vaguely applied statutes, like New York City's more recent stop and frisk law, the cabaret law was disproportionately used throughout history to squeeze African Americans and other minorities. The law was passed back in 1926, and it was created to prevent interracial mingling at Harlem bars, according to the New York Post. Paul Shavigny has written an entire book about the history of jazz in New York City. It's called Gigs, Jazz and the Cabaret Laws in New York. And he says that the Alderman's Committee on Local Laws was pretty clear about the racial motivations for the ban when it was first passed in the 1960s. The committee said at the time that it was trying to check the wild people who were tumbling out of these resorts at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning and to the scandal and annoyance of decent residents on their way to daily employment. Shavigny is one of several people to unsuccessfully challenge the cabaret law in court. "I don't think in this day and age we need dancing police," he told New York Magazine in 2005. "Let's get serious. Who cares if you dance?" New York City certainly does care. For the first decade of the law's existence, it actually banned all music in bars, period. Then in 1936, it was updated to allow, gasp, piano playing in bars and restaurants. In 1943, the law was expanded to require musicians to carry a cabaret card if they wanted to perform in the city. And to get one of those, performers had to submit to being fingerprinted by the New York City Police Department and were subjected to interrogations about their personal life, mostly focused on potential drug use, before they could be certified as worthy and wholesome. Cards had to be reviewed every 2 years, and the authorities were free to revoke or deny those renewals whenever they wanted, as Vice detailed in a piece earlier this year looking at the history of the cabaret law. Rather than submit to the city's government's absurd licensing scheme, Frank Sinatra refused for decades to perform in New York. He reportedly said that he would not seek a cabaret card because he didn't subject himself to the indignity of being fingerprinted, mugged, and quizzed about his past. His public opposition to the law helped loosen some of the requirements for performers, but the cabaret law stayed on the books as what the New York Post calls a haphazard enforcement tool to keep bar owners in line at the city's whims. Now, technically, every church, ballet studio, and high school prom in New York violates the cabaret law. Andrew Muchmore, a lawyer and bar owner from Brooklyn, pointed out as much during a 2014 lawsuit that challenged the law as an unconstitutional violation of the First Amendment. But city officials have always liked the cabaret law, Muchmore told the Village Voice earlier this year, because it gives them a way to arbitrarily shut down places they have problems with. Muchmore says he thinks it's just one more tool in their infinite toolbox to cause problems for any place they want to cause problems for. But this arbitrary, potentially racist, and certainly nonsensical restriction on how New Yorkers can get down and turn loose at bars and clubs across the city is, thankfully, finally headed for the rubbish bin of history where I think we can all agree it belongs. Hey, that sounds like an excuse to do a happy dance. Kick off your Sunday shoes, folks. I'm Eric Boehm for Reason Magazine. We'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Are women better off in communist nations than they are in capitalist countries like the United States? Dr. Paul Kangor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College takes a look at the historical record on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The New York Times recently published a stunning piece of political propaganda that we would have once expected from the Daily Worker or Pravda. In fact, once upon a time, it would have been immediately recognized as silly communist propaganda fomented by a party organ in Beijing or Havana. Yes, the Times published a jaw-dropper on how communism has been just fabulous for women, especially in China. Quote, "The communists did many terrible things," began this latest Times contribution, "but they made women's lives much better," unquote. Do tell us more, dear comrade. The piece stems from the same old left-wing pablum. Communism sent women into the workforce. That was a good thing. Communism generously took care of women's burdensome children in daycare centers. Communism gave women magnificent new rights, read abortion. Communism handed women great free education. And communism generally turned these lucky women worker bees of the proletariat into a dazzling new form of communist woman. Schools, factories, farms, abortion clinics, and 24/7 state daycare for the worker child. Not too shabby, eh, comrade? Pretty pathetic, actually. In fact, downright tragic. But a close read of this particular article in the New York Times is actually worse than that. The author argued that Mao's Chinese totalitarian state didn't quite go far enough into the home. It didn't do enough in freeing women of their lousy household chores and children. The author wrote, quote, "While the Communist Revolution brought women more job opportunities, it also made their interests subordinate to collective goals. Stopping at the household doorstep, Mao's words and policies did little to alleviate women's domestic burdens, like housework and childcare. While women indeed contributed enormously to collective farming, they rarely rose to positions of responsibility." The author continued, "The urban workplace was hardly more inspiring. Women were shunted to collective neighborhood workshops with meager pay and dismal working conditions, while men were more commonly employed in comfortable big industry and state enterprise jobs," unquote. In this author's view in the New York Times, the collectivist administrative state in China didn't manage women's lives intimately enough. Incredibly, in this awful article, there is no mention of poverty or starvation for women in communist China, where more people died than in any other country under communism. No small achievement. The latest research pegs the number near 70 to 80 million Chinese dead. That's more than died under Stalin's Russia. It also vastly surpasses the total that Hitler murdered, and it's actually higher than the combined death tolls of World War I and II. The article doesn't mention the Chinese government's one-child cap on the offspring that Chinese women were permitted to bear, the forced abortion or sterilization, the abandoned or baby girls, the lives of prostitution assumed by countless Chinese women, or the fact that female infanticide is more prevalent in China than any other nation. There's no mention that, get this, China owns 20% of the world's women, but 56% of the world's female suicides. According to the World Bank and World Health Organization, about 500 Chinese women kill themselves every day. Women under Chinese communism have killed themselves at a stunning rate. And modern China actually faces a stunning demographic reality of tens, if not hundreds of millions of missing women, particularly due to the one-child policy. What kind of an achievement is that for women? The fact is that life for women in China sucks. But the Times wasn't focused on that. No, it's a new day at the Times, a day and time to hail, not condemn the achievements of Red China. Women of the world, unite! For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include our newest affiliates, the stations of the Wilkins Radio Network, which include KIOU-AM in Shreveport, Louisiana, WASG-AM in Mobile, Alabama, along with WDZY-AM in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to our new listeners in the Pelican, Yellowhammer, and Old Dominion states. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.